Good morning, everyone. Well, I will start by saying I have no financial relations to disclose. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually take us back to Julie's presentation, because what I'm going to be talking about with North Carolina's efforts to improve population health builds a lot on what Julie was talking about in her presentation. And I almost wish, and I should have thought about this beforehand, that last slide you had, I could have sort of built it into the side, and then you can see sort of how we got to a lot of what she's talking about, did it a different way, but got to the sort of same results. So let me start by telling you a little bit about who we are. You heard a little bit in my introduction, but I'm the president of the North Carolina Institute of Medicine. You all know the Institute of Medicine. They don't have state affiliates. We borrowed their name. We have been in the General Assembly created us in 1983, and we're modeled after the Institute of Medicine, but we study health problems facing the state of North Carolina. So about 4 years ago, we started focusing more on population health. I had Leah Devlin, who some of you know, who was our state health director for many years, was on my board. And she'd been pushing us to get involved in prevention, but we actually started getting involved in prevention work when two of our major health foundations in this state came to us independently and said, we want you to do a study looking at population health. So we started before the first release of the county rankings. We got to a sort of, again, similar results of what you had been talking about. You can see from the graphic that if you look at America's health rankings, which is sort of what we were looking at, we are historically in the bottom third. And if you look at almost any issue, we are in the bottom third. There's actually one area where we are in the top, and nobody in my state can understand why, which is use of alcohol. We are actually do very well, and if you talk to anybody in our substance abuse agency, nobody can understand those data. But everything else, we are at the bottom third. So we were asked, as I said before, by our Health and Wellness Trust Fund, which was, and I emphasize was, and I'll mention this a little bit later, it was one of our tobacco settlement foundations that focused on health that no longer exists. And we were also asked by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina Foundation if we would study prevention. And ironically, it was within a month's time they both came to me independently and said, would you do this study? So there were two of the major foundations. We then reached out to our other major foundations, talking about partners and partnerships. We reached out to the four major health foundations in North Carolina. It was the first time all four of them collaborated on any project. And what we did was to really help develop a prevention action plan for the state. I've got at the very end the websites if you ever want to take a look at it. But we took four steps in developing that. First is we looked at the underlying causes of death and disability in our state. You've all seen the data that show the underlying preventable risk factors that are due to the leading reasons for death. We went a step further and also looked at the leading causes of disability in the state, because there are certain things like mental health that don't come up as high when you're just looking at death data, but do come up pretty high when you're looking at disability-related data. So we looked at the underlying leading causes of death and disability in the state. We then looked at what those preventable risk factors, because our goal was to really focus on prevention. We then looked at the evidence-based strategies. So we're very excited, Julie, that you're going to be putting together that list, because we did that through sort of evidence, looking at the evidence. And then we came up with multi-leveled interventions that could try to address it. So again, going back to that last slide, we have a lot of those multi-level interventions in our recommendations. And these were the 10 areas that we looked at when we developed our prevention action plan. Our prevention action plan is 350 pages, so we boiled it down to a 16-page issue brief, and then we have one-page sort of action steps for different segments. So the hospitals have one, the doctors have one, the businesses have one, to try to really create a campaign, which is what you'll see in the end is where we're going to. The result is this common document that is being used primarily by our health groups and by our public health community to try to drive population-based change. And we had 45 different evidence-based recommendations, 11 of which were priorities, and we've already seen some positive action on some of those. That led us into the foundations coming back and said, actually it was the Division of Public Health came back and said, we want you to get involved in helping us develop our Healthy North Carolina 2020 objectives. Theoretically, it should have been the other way around, but we started this before the decennial health objectives. So we got involved in doing the health objectives. Now, to put this in perspective, in 2010, North Carolina had 108 objectives. This time around, we said that was way too much. You can't focus on 108 things. And if you're going to do this, you have to do it collectively, and you got to focus on the same target. So we came up with what you'll see is that we ended up, well, let me first tell you the process, and then I'll tell you where we got to. We identified the different focus areas, and we built up the prevention action plan. We identified a limited number of objectives. This was really hard to people who are committed to it to say, you can only pick three. What are the objectives going to be, and what is the critical objective? So we came up with three objectives in each area except for one. And then we came up with a target that was ambitious yet achievable. So we didn't come up with something that there'd be no way that we could achieve. And so we picked the same areas that we had with the Prevention Action Plan, but we added in oral health, maternal and infant health, chronic diseases, and cross-cutting issues. And if you look at our list and you look at what was just released yesterday with the priorities for the National Health Prevention, they're very similar. And there's an email going around today saying how they've all built off of North Carolina's priorities. So we ended up with 40 objectives in 13 different areas. We had 150 people involved, and the goal of this is now to get everybody working on those 40 objectives, or as many people as we can, focusing on the same areas, to develop multi-level interventions around those different areas, and to provide county-level data for that as much as possible. So we're using some of your county-level data, but we're also developing our own infrastructure so we can come up with our county data around those 40 objectives. So what we have now is we have the Prevention Action Plan, we have the Healthy North Carolina 2020. We've restructured the way our public health division is operating so that there's going to be technical assistance at the state level for counties that want to work on those objectives. One of the things that now each county health department or each local health department has to do as a result of this is, as part of their contract with the state, they have to pick at least two of the objectives in different areas to say that that is going to be part of their work plan. We have an epidemiology, surveillance, and monitoring. We've gotten funding to enhance our state health center for health statistics to be able to identify some of those at the county, some of those data at the county level. We've been doing accreditation for a while, so. And if you have more questions about accreditation, I'll turn it over to Jean, whose office is doing that. So our state health department, our local health departments have been involved in accreditation for a long time. And we've had this broader coalition of groups that are trying to work on it. Because of all this work, the bad side of it, the politics of it that Patrick was talking about earlier, is that in the most recent recession, we have lost a lot of state funding. So while we've got these great plans for how to improve population health, we're losing money. We lost the Health and Wellness Trust Fund. So what we are starting to see is that all of these groups are coming together to try to identify other funding sources to meet the objectives that we've got. And the place that they're going to right now is the Affordable Care Act. And we have been very successful in getting monies from the Affordable Care Act to try to address some of the things that were in our Healthy North Carolina 2020 and our Prevention Action Plan. So tobacco use, gotten the fourth largest community transformation grant. It's going to be used for tobacco use cessation activities and for physical activity and nutrition activity enhancement. And so some of those things are to focus on getting cigarettes and tobacco use out of community colleges, out of public places, out of parks. It's the multi-level intervention. That's why I'd love to see Julie's slide back up there, because I could have just gone check, check, check. Physical activity and nutrition, we're talking about more farmers markets, we're talking about getting rid of food deserts, we're talking about having convenience stores where you'll have fresh fruits and vegetables, so a lot of the activities there. For maternal and infant health, We got a lot, just like I'm sure many of your states got, we got home visiting money, so we're implementing the Nurse Family Partnership and trying to do some work around infant mortality reduction and improving families and children, services for families and children. We have funding for on the STD, unintended pregnancy, foodborne illness, social determinants of health. And then the other two things are not within our prevention action plan, but they go back to the infrastructure. One is the funding to help support, to expand the state's Center for Health Statistics, the data that they collect so that it can really provide us county-level data. And then the other one is really to help work both on our quality improvement activities at local public health and our accreditation activities. And Jean, as I said, could talk more about that. So the bottom line, I know that I'm running out of my time as well, and I'll put up this. This is a nice quote that Jeff Engel, who is our state health director, said about the work that we were doing, which made us very ready to go after the Accountable Care Act funds. We face some of the same challenges that everybody you've heard about today talked about. We face the problem with we have a new legislature that is hasn't historically been focused on population health. We had a huge recession, and we're still one of the states with the highest unemployment rates, so we are struggling with how we're going to fund all these services. So we have efforts to do more regionalization, which you've heard a lot about today. What we have going, I think, is that we have had strong partnerships with a lot of different organizations, and we've already identified those key areas that we're going to focus in on that are really, that we're all going to work together on. And our partnerships include the Hospital Association, our major insurance carriers. We have the Medical Society involved in it. We don't have as strong a connections with the employer community, although we have some connections in the employer community. And I think that's what's going to help build us and move us to the next stage of our efforts. So with that, I'll end and then be open for questions.
First, I'd ask you to join me in thanking all four of the presenters for really well done. You may have felt some of the pressure of the speakers. We did contract the amount of time purposefully to have more question and answer time. I also understand, and I'll ask Lisa to explain, if you want to see the slides, they are, you can get to them, as I understand it.
Well, my understanding is we'll have to upload them as a handout, and I don't know if that's still a possibility, but I know. Someone knows.
No, we're all hoping that that is what's going to happen here. People have said that, but I've never seen anything official.
I'll make a point, at least insofar as I can as a moderator, to push that message back. Stay tuned and check periodically. The abstracts of all the sessions are available online. With that, let me open it to questions. Questions to the panel as a whole, targeted to an individual. And all of the panelists, please feel free to respond. We'll start with the lady here. We'll go this way and then to Jan.
Hi. Thanks for the presentation. I had a question specifically for Massachusetts with regards to the role of the state public health agencies regionalization efforts. Are they serving as a funding agency for services? How does that relationship pan out?
Repeat the question.
So the question is, what's the role of the State Department of Public Health in supporting multi-jurisdictional solution? At the moment, it is through funding. They receive CDC funding to improve the public health infrastructure, so they're passing the money through to local groups who want to share services. But I think the state has also been great about identifying the sorts of technical assistance and making technical assistance that would be needed for the state. The degree to which that role will change over time is yet to be seen, I think. But they've been active at the table and thinking about how to improve the infrastructure and saw this grant opportunity to do that.
I got two questions. For the lady from North Carolina, who's the WHO that's going going to do the transforming of the community and our infrastructure policies.
And mostly it's going to be local health directed, local public health. They've got, maybe 2 years ago, the General Assembly passed the smoke-free law that applied to restaurants, but gave the counties the authority to do smoke-free policies in public places and work sites. So the local health directors will be going to the county commissioners or the public health agencies to try to get that done. And there is, in fact, a lot of communities that are already doing that.
Okay, thank you. But surely, that, have you, in the county health rankings, has there been an approach to try to understand the capacity to make change and those outcomes based on the system that resides within the county? Has anyone ever tried to quantify the capacity to actually make change as a part of those rankings, those outcomes?
I'm not sure. You mean measured capacity within the community, within community systems and community partners?
Either within a governmental health system, mm-hmm. or the total public health system, and do you ever adjust for where there's multiple public health agencies, governmental public health agencies within one county who may have very jurisdictional type of issues?
No, but I will say there's more and more PHSS. Public health systems and services research work being done using the county health rankings, and so I think there's great opportunity for further exploration in that arena.
If it could be qualified, it might be helpful to some of the anchoring that we really need to get through. The
And the other, from a more qualitative standpoint, we are doing case studies and sharing stories and trying to connect people on a action real base level, but I think you're asking for our measurements to go further.
Gene and this gentleman and the gentleman over here.
Question for Justine. You sort of ended up with three identified patterns of structures of how these sharings were taking place, some a little more formally, some less. Did you draw any lessons or intuitions out of what is going on or why they're picking one of those three flavors as they move forward? And is it a continuum of progression or some of them just going into that slice of the spectrum and going to stay there?
Yeah. The short answer is politics. I don't.
Shop.
There is
what
not,
are you doing in this session?
Yeah, there is not a clear set of characteristics that I would say define a group of municipalities that make them more likely to choose one or the other. It really depends on their approach. So if the leader and the facilitator came in and said, we're moving towards a comprehensive, what we're going to do is where we're bringing people along, that tends to be, they tend to be further along the comprehensive spectrum. But there are also communities who went in with that, and at the end of the day, that's not what the people around the table really wanted. And so they're starting slow, getting their feet wet with, just trying to work together in the sandbox nicely, and then see if that can grow and expand over time. But it's a mix of rural communities and urban communities that are in either end of the spectrum. I would say those that are in the more comprehensive spectrum have leaders with a stronger public health training background and have a better sense of the full array of public health services that we should be providing. That might be the one characteristic that I can also
think. So, this panel has really focused on public health as a way of improving health services, health status, and hasn't focused really on the investment in medical care as a way of influencing health status. And yet there's a lot of public money in medical care, the majority of health care services are paid for through public money. It seems like you're in a good position to compare the efficiency, effectiveness, and equity of public investments in medical care versus community, versus public health. And in fact, that dialogue, I think, needs to happen if we're going to not only salvage public health from the marginal position it's in, but bridge the gap so that they can be more effectively coordinated. I saw some of the sponsors for this public health work were Blue Cross Blue Shield and hospitals, but I'm wondering to what extent you're seeing feasible strategies for bridging the invisible divide between public health and medical care in the interest of improving health status.
Let's start with a couple of comments and then let others speak. Again, with the focus of this session being the political implications, it may have narrowed that discussion. Having said that, in some of the work I did in meetings, and in particular, I'm remembering a comment from folks at the National Governors Association, when part of our dialogue process posed the question of how to have public health infrastructure be more a part of a governor's priorities, the person very bluntly, and I won't give you the exact quote because it was that blunt, basically said, you are asking the question backwards. You better figure out how public changes in public health infrastructure will move a governor's agenda. And for the foreseeable future, that agenda is economic development, jobs, and possibly education. My takeaway from that, and some things I've been thinking about, we have not translated our understanding and knowledge in terms, and we haven't, frankly, done very much research on returns in population-based interventions that have meaning to political decision-makers. And the general rubric of for every dollar spent on immunizations, you save $8. Well, the critical question is, who saves? When do they save? Whose appropriation? We have to become much more... I'm on my soapbox. I apologize. We have to become much more sophisticated in our discussion. We tend to think of the value add from our value set. We've got to get our mind around the value set of others, particularly those who are in decision-making roles, and demonstrate in ways that have meaning to them the value add to their direction. I'll stop my rant there.
Okay, so I'm gonna respond more to the question, which I totally agree with what you're saying. So I'm not to take away from what you said, Kevin. In North Carolina, we have a unique Medicaid managed care program. It's called Community Care of North Carolina. It was an award-winning program, and it is a program which is, for those of you who know Medicaid managed care, it's not HMOs, it's an enhanced, basically it's a patient-centered medical home, if you want to use jargon. It's a patient-centered medical home. But when they designed it, which was 10 or so years ago, in order to develop it, they had to have the major primary care provider, the hospital at the table, the social services at the table, and local health at the table. And it was recognizing that there's a broader socio-ecological model that impacts on health status. Those community care North Carolina networks are responsible for population health. Now, they tend to be diabetes and asthma related, so they tend to be secondary prevention rather than primary prevention. But what you're seeing in part of the community transformation grant is we are now, so local public health has always been at the table and really well integrated, or pretty well integrated, I can't say it's perfect. What we're starting to see in the community transformation grant is that we are now using that CCNC network around tobacco cessation, and we're going to be using the counseling that primary care providers should be doing around getting people to quit smoking and referring them into our quit line is going to be part of what they're going to be measured on as part of their CCNC improvement efforts. So there's more of an effort of moving for primary prevention, not just secondary prevention and treatment of chronic illness.
I'm going to bring it back to the topic here. And I have to give a quick background. Until 5 months ago, I was probably on the dark side. It was a
way things are presented now. I was a government official who was responsible for things other than healthcare and other stuff. And your initial statement, I was at first disagreed with, but now that your final statement, I agree with. That's that I think, and there is a question, and but I do have to make this comment. I think that part of what's going on is that public health has come to the government as if it was an entity unto itself. And that has been a major flaw. Because as a government official, what we were wanting to hear is there's a couple things that really are the key issues. First of all, public health is part of self-sufficiency. How do you link with the other aspects of self-sufficiency? And therefore, how can we measure return on the community's investment in putting in public health? So it's two parts. How do you tie to other things? And public health, the definition of the community, et cetera. And I'm sorry, folks, right now it is jobs, you know, short term. So therefore, how does it, and the argument, well, if you're not healthy, you can't work. If you don't have all this stuff. And that's, and what happened was, we kept pushing back. And finally, as government, we developed a model. Because the other thing is, if you look in the literature, there is not a very good econometric model that shows the payback of healthcare coverage. So therefore, the whole argument of healthcare coverage and public health has been a value-laden argument. It's not an econometric model from the standpoint of a government official. With that tirade, my question
you
is...
You feel better now.
I feel better. I feel much better. Now I'm on the other side, and actually with the university, and this is one of my interests in going this area. But, so my question for the people on the panel, with that, what are you all doing, and do you have anything that you can share that you're doing with regard to that question?
So I would say, half of my work is research and the other half is at the Professional Association for All Local Public Health Directors in Colorado. And we also support the Association for Local Boards of Health in Colorado. Many of you, as you heard, are elected officials. So we're friends with our NACO affiliate, Colorado County Inc. And so we're sort of constantly talking with them about this. How do county commissioners hear and think about public health? In an orientation that I presented last summer to a new set of county commissioners, I posed it like this. Of course you care about the whole aspect of all of both the departments within your county, but also all of the services that you're providing. The question that I request that you ask is when you make a decision about a road, about a pothole, about an issue in your roads and bridge section, think to yourself for one moment, how does that decision impact the health of my community? If you can't answer it, go to your public health director and ask them. And if they can't answer it, they've got us. You know, they've got the professional association that they can come to. So instead of making it all about public health, taking the questions that the decisions that they're already making and saying, just for one moment, as you're making that decision and asking, how is this impacting economics? How is this impacting jobs? How is this impacting all of those things? Ask that one more. And how is this road expansion going to impact health? And is there a way that I can better inform the decision that I'm going to make about this road, knowing how it's going to impact health? Now, it may not change the decision, but you at least for a moment thought about that and made a little bit broader, informed decision. I don't know if that speaks at all to your thinking.
I would say that we are, we suffer from a lack of data at all in our state. We don't report up to the state very much to make a case that we're improving population health. But one of the things that we're doing is we're going to our legislative leaders right now as part of our evaluation of the district and Senate grants and asking them what kind of outcomes make a difference to them. What would they like us to keep track of? What makes sense? What moves the needle for them? And we're going to try to incorporate those outcomes into our evaluation of these service sharing.
couple things I would say in response, and I would agree, there isn't necessarily great data demonstrating the investment in insurance, but I would suggest from a political framework, the constituency or the electorate or the population's expectation and demand for that overrides the lack of data in a political decision making. Because there's an expectation and a belief that much of what health is will be done in that relationship, isn't a parallel construction in public health or larger scale prevention. Things that need to happen more, and it's limited, I think we can make some economic arguments and tie economic arguments more readily to clinical preventive services. The risk in doing that, in some respects also, is you're going to point out a number of preventive practices in a clinical setting that really don't demonstrate the kind of cost return. So you're still going to have a public expectation gap, and we've seen that recently, examples periodically. Lastly, and it's very, very fledgling, I point you to Trust for America's Health and some other organizations that have started to do good economic modeling on population-based prevention activities. There's an activity in walking kind of a program in California that they've done an economic model on. Tobacco has some pretty good economic kinds of things. And then the last piece I'd add, and one I'd also point you to, is Nurse Family Partnership that has a really good long-term data set and can pinpoint the return by sector. If we do this, we will see this level of drop in the juvenile justice systems by X. And those things start to have some impact. I guess the last thing I add is there is work underway to modify, one of the difficulties is to modify, better understanding the offset notion of how the Congressional Budget Office calculates return on prevention or preventive efforts that give you a little different or better horizon. I can remember being thrown out of the then person who was the principal author of the budget in our state, laughingly, but not so laughingly, saying he couldn't afford to save any more money this biennium in terms of what I was pushing. And I couldn't give him enough, or we couldn't give him the kind of detail that made that investment other than an act of faith.
Because I think also from an infrastructure standpoint, very few communities talk about the impact on public health and zoning.
Yeah.
And therefore you have the comprehensive planning people that, or in small communities, what about the people in code enforcement? Why do you send one person in because they have a problem with their well? And you send another person in because they leave their trash. So that's the kind of thing that I think has been with the elected officials, when you're not going in with a willingness to look at that in these tight terms, they're going to throw you out of there.
One of the other things, just as an aside, I haven't seen the data myself, but I've seen it referenced, is that if you talk to some economic recruiters about what do businesses look for when they decide where they're going to locate, I've seen health on that list, the health of the community. And that's
obesity levels.
Pardon?
Obesity levels.
Yeah, obesity levels in particular, right.
Yes, ma'am.
Just in history, in the late 80s, there was an econometric model run by Jack Hadley, who is a health economist at Georgetown, who showed the contributions of the various determinants of health. And in that model, he showed that medical care was one of the lesser determinants, that it was the social determinants. And I think Jack's work was some of the path-breaking work, and there have been a number of econometric models that have shown various combinations such that one could go from there and probably do some micro analyses and get some ROIs on the various components. So as a doctoral student, I remember that very well. And so even those who were on the dark side in the 80s.
The only thing I'd add to that, I think we in public health still need to take it up a notch and understand it and describe it not only in broad economic terms, but in the political specificity of appropriation thinking. that's the short-term decision framework most often. Yeah.
But this is the basis, I think, there have been a lot of other things done since then. So economic modeling is probably 20-plus years old.
Can I just say, so many of these questions harken to our conversations with our disease research about public health services research and the need for experienced researchers in HSR to look at public health as a delivery system and as a system and use the tools that have been tested in sort of more of a healthcare system at this more public health, so that we can decide if those tools are useful and if they work in public health, they need to be tweaked, test them. But that's really just a call that I think Robert Duncan has for quite some time now to think about using those tools in the public health arena. And then finding those linkages and where do they rub together? And even understanding sort of that.
Another couple of questions, and we'll wrap up as we're approaching time. Don't want to cut it off, but also want to be respectful of your potential lunch and get that plastic wrap sandwich and off to the next. So, gentleman here, and then my friend in the back.
One of the regulatory tools that states have, that the majority of states have, is certificate of need. Certificate of need is a major lever for growth in the medical care system, particularly around the hospitals. For every investment in the hospital, then there are operational costs that the government is actually contributing to, certainly in Medicaid, through the state and federal government. I have been told that the reason CON is not used more to stop the excess spending is that the dollars that are coming into the state represent jobs, which you tell me is what government's supposed to be concerned about now. And I mean that they claim to be interested in it.
Yeah, I don't want ownership of the I'm just the messenger.
But so CON is a lever that could be used to restrict growth in medical care, but there are economic consequences in jobs. On the other hand, if there wasn't a divide between medical care and public health, one could imagine that the state would develop a strategic plan the way health systems agencies had responsibility for in the 1970s in trying to figure out where is the better investment. Is it in medical care, and if so, where within a geographical area? Or is it in social determinants of health? And can we use that same global budget, in a sense, for planning? Seems to me this is the strategic issue that we really are facing if we want to deal with the unsustainability of the healthcare delivery system, or if we're interested in reducing inequalities, which I think most people in this society are.
Well, I would just comment, that building on that, another lever we have moving forward is the whole new enhanced requirement of community health needs assessment that hospitals will be required to do to meet their IRS regulations. And I think that the golden opportunity about talking about key partners coming together, changing the conversation about a broad-based social determinant of health model to be used in those community health needs assessments and be used to drive the allocation of those community benefit dollars, especially as we hopefully face the time in 2014 where more people will be coming in with coverage and the community benefit dollars will not need to be used for charity care. So I think that's a great opportunity that today is the day to seize the day.
Let me, it's a great pleasure to have Elaine have the final word.
You've done a great job of describing moving forward in a shared services methodology in several states. My question is, think we are rapidly running out of that luxury, and some states, Washington being one of those, due to very awful budget cuts. What advice would we have if, in fact, we have to move forward with a regionalization model that is not necessarily a shared services delivery model? And I think we're facing that decision that that's the point we can bring. I think we're faced with that decision probably very quickly, depending on what the legislature does or does not do in special session or next regular session.
So I'm sorry, can you just the administration, someone else is, that's the question.
Forced.
Someone else will address.
I think either public health is going to have to step forward and say this is what we need to do, or I think either legislature or DOH will say this is, by the way, what you are going to do.
So I would say, I mean, certainly regions have been drawn in Colorado. I think the last count was we had like 21. Terrific, thanks, Colorado, 21 different regions have been drawn with very levels of interest and success, and et cetera. I think when you're thinking about the infrastructure for the public health agencies themselves, Massachusetts and Colorado are probably not the states to talk to. You should be talking to Nebraska and Kansas and places that have gone through that process of drawing the lines and find out what were their pitfalls. And I think you'll hear from both of us, there is a little bit of just draw lines for us. Even though we're in this very organic, hopefully at the end of the day it'll be a much more agreed upon environment. There is still some frustration. So I don't know that there's a right or wrong. And I think there's certainly other states that are in the exact situation that they're in. And part of it is the communication amongst ourselves to avoid what we know is has gone wrong. When,
yeah. North Carolina is facing exactly the same thing.
I would hope that somebody, it could be the State Department of Public Health, it could be one of the leaders within this newly formed entity, it could be an academic partner. I mean, if the state, if whoever is going to draw those boundaries, could take a leadership role in recognizing that this is going to be a challenging move and that some resources need to be invested in strategic planning. I mean, I don't know, we can all do what North Carolina has done because that's pretty spectacular, but as, you know, a newly formed entity, what are our population health outcomes that we want to achieve? How do we work strategically together? Who, you know, building relationships, just who's at the table and what do you currently do and how do you do your work? And, you know, there's that initial relationship building, and then there's that joint visioning and planning that I think will help. I can't help but think that that wouldn't help. And I think it's overseen a lot in the, you know, a frenzy of getting mushed together and the bad feelings that arise from that and keep it wet and the butt gets lost.
I think, I was meeting in Ohio with health officials, local health officials, who were beginning a task force to look at this question. Was it 180 local health departments?
127. An 88
counties. Yeah, I'm sorry. I knew there was an 80 in there somewhere. And they were kind of laying out almost a year-long work plan, because this was a tough issue for them. And then they went into their general meeting after this group meeting, at which the governor's lead person on health, not the department, announced the governor's intent to reduce the number of health departments. So two things I think came out of that. One was, maybe we don't have a whole year to really work this one. So sped it up on that end. But the other, and the silver lining, where I'm going with this, is when he was informed that health officials were working this issue, it took a little of the pressure off. The lines weren't necessarily, there was a freedom to say that the lines wouldn't then be drawn necessarily in the governor's office, if this work is underway. So, and I would connect that to a statement that Justine made and something we saw in our work. Clarity of purpose. Reduction of cost, depending on where you sit, is a legitimate policy objective. But we saw regionalization, particularly in one state, significantly reduce the number of health departments and ended up in less capacity in these newly formed combined districts because they didn't also have clarity of purpose around public health and the like. You have to introduce both to have the potential of at least safeguarding, if not potentially improving, or setting the stage for improvement into the future. So that notion of getting the public health capacity management as a goal equal to if cost reduction is the driver also into that discussion.
There is another significant factor in the whole equation, and that's how the states or how local public health is funded in the states, and that varies greatly. In Kansas, for example, it's primarily funded by local taxes. And so the state's influence is pretty minimal in that process. That's not true in many other states, I think. And so the approach in terms of who's going to be able to make the decisions is going to vary significantly.
Mindful and respectful of your time to the point of being 15 minutes beyond it. Again, thanks to the panel for their presentation.